From the Sky News Centre at 5. More of the UK's top rides have been shut down following the roller coaster crash at Alton Towers. Barry Weir's been hearing from the firm that runs the theme parks.
I am not sitting here shirking responsibility.
That's the boss of Merlin Entertainment's Nick Varney. Two rides will be closed long term. The Smiler, which left four people injured on Tuesday, and a similar attraction called Saw at Thorpe Park. Rattlesnake and Dragon's Fury at Chessington will close for a few days until new safety protocols are applied.
Cannot be instantly implemented. There needs to be technical and training upgrades.
Meanwhile, the carriages involved in Tuesday's crash are being taken away for tests.
Charles Kennedy's family says he died as a result of a major hemorrhage that was a result of his battle with alcoholism. Relatives of the former Lib Dem leader have issued a statement following his sudden death at his home in Fort William on Monday. They say his alcoholism was an illness he couldn't conquer. Ex-director of communications at Downing Street, Alistair Campbell, knew Mr Kennedy well.
It's an illness, it's a disease. Some people get it, some people don't. The same as cancer or diabetes or asthma or anything else. And it's true that every time Charles or you or me or anybody else, every time we lift a glass, that's a choice that we make. But we don't make a choice to become alcoholic.
A successful businesswoman has been jailed for 9 years for running a multi-million pound drug operation. Bolton Crown Court heard she led a lavish lifestyle from selling substances claiming to be legal highs over the internet. Four Polish lorry drivers are being held by police. It's after 68 suspected illegal immigrants were discovered in lorries at Harwich Port in Essex. In sport, Andy Murray is underway in his French Open semi-final with world number one Novak Djokovic. They're in the first set and it was going with serve a short time ago. The winner will play Stan Wawrinka, who beat Joe Wilfried Tsonga in four sets. And the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge will christen their daughter Princess Charlotte in a private ceremony at Sandringham next month. That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message. I love you. Now back to our show.
Love Bristol. Love BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, it's leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, Councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, for many, Westminster makes a rather poor sideshow. In the wake of May's general election, it's a good idea to remind ourselves who really runs things. Well, many think the G7 and the Bilderberg. They're meeting over the next week or so, and geographically in the centre of NATO power. That's Germany and Austria, close to the Swiss-German border. This weekend, the leaders of the G7 countries are meeting in Schloss Elmau near Mittenwald in Bavaria, Germany. And we'll be discussing that after the 6 o'clock news. Also after that is the Henry Kissinger's Bilderberg Conference. So if you wonder why politics isn't working for you, why our taxpayers' money is spent how big business want it rather than how we want, you need to look no further next week than a short drive from Hitler's birthplace in Austria. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. To our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 18, a mainly sunny weekend. Next week, highs of 21 Celsius. Plenty of sunshine this week, but possible showers as you get towards the end of the week, particularly on Friday. Feeling warmer, though, as the week progresses. Next weekend, that's the 13th and 14th of June, highs of 18 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the weather outlook.com. thegcn.com. So, helping us review this week's news is leader of the Conservative Group and councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Now, first of all, let's start by looking at this thing that's dropped through our letterboxes this week. It's Our City, June 2015. How much does this cost us? Because I look at this and I think this is just some kind of George Ferguson propaganda sheet. It's all full of all these wonderful stories about
how... Oh, it's definitely a George love mag.
How, yeah, so all sorts of different subjects, but all very much spun from a City Council is wonderful point of view. Lots of pictures of George Ferguson with his red trousers, stood next to children, and really no kind of attempt at balance.
It cost $34,000, which will remind him next time he's trying to axe a library. Cost him $34,000, and it is purely a publicity rag for himself.
Now, how does he get away with that, then? I mean, surely councillors can say, hang on, you know, at least we want a few pictures of councillors in here too.
I think you'll find that was a fait accompli when it was put out, and I think it was council's view, if we were asked, would be that the money could be better spent elsewhere, actually supporting council services, rather than spent on something that glorifies the great and almighty leader.
And also, when it comes to policies around the city, I mean, is there any way that you, as political parties, can actually get your point of view in here? After all, it's you who we elect.
Well, you also elect George. So George is the one that is the mayor. He has the executive function. He controls the budget. Admittedly, the council sets the broad parameters. But the day-to-day, he runs it.
Well, this is his. Getting into a discussion, isn't it, about what is the mayor, what is George, what is the point of electing you, Mark?
Well, actually, you elect the councillors because they represent you locally. I mean, George doesn't know the detail of what happens in wards, so councillors represent their communities to him and fight when there's an issue,
etc. So are you just George Ferguson's eyes and ears and nothing more?
No, nothing more than that. Often we provide the scrutiny and the check and the balance. In my opinion, actually, the legislation which governs George needs to be reviewed because at present, the council has very few powers that can actually overrule George on. We can control the budget, we set the budget, and he has to have a cabinet made up of at least three councillors. And there isn't a great deal more than that that a council actually has. I personally think we need to move to a situation where a supermajority of councillors can overrule the executive if he's doing something stupid, like spending $34,000 on a... publicity mag.
Well, he has actually. I mean, to be fair to George, he's put not that he's. I suppose he's sort of.
We're mentioned on the second to last page.
Yes, that's right. Right at the very back, there's a list of councillors, and it does say if you look very, very carefully which party they've been elected to.
I think it's in about tight eight. Text,
yes,
I
it is rather it is, small,
and actually, everything else is in about 12.
Much bigger is the big section beforehand with a picture of George and his cabinet, yeah. and the details of who the assistant mayors are and deputy mayors. So you've got a sort of situation where you've got a mayor, you've got a deputy mayor who's a Conservative.
The thing is, I remember when Lib Dem and Labour councillors did the same thing, and actually, this was one of those things we successfully fought against, and it got scrapped. And now it seems that George, for the first time in his morality, has decided to bring it back. Anyone might think there's an election in 12 months.
Possibly, yeah. Also, I noticed that the deputy mayor, who's directly underneath George, is a Conservative, although Conservatives aren't the largest party in the city. How does that happen?
Well, George appoints his cabinet. He can appoint who he wants to it. He tries to go for political balance where possible.
Okay, so if we had two or three BNP councillors, for example, we don't have.
No, that would be too low.
And George could actually choose those two or three councillors as his cabinet and ignore the whole of the rest of the city if he wanted.
If he wanted to, he could do it. I would suggest to him that was a risky step to take, but he could theoretically do it.
Martin, Bristol was the only city, whatever it was, it's about 5 years ago now when we had our referendum as to whether we wanted a mayor to vote for it. All the other cities that took part in that round of elections as to whether to have a mayor said no. How do you think it's all worked out?
Well, I think I tend to agree with various people who've been on this show suggesting that there ought to be an option to get rid of the mayor as a concept if we're unhappy with it. Because I believe previously there has been a way back if people have not been happy with, and in various parts of the country they have experimented with mayors and decided they don't want them. And I think that surely makes sense to me.
I mean, if you
try something you don't like,
isn't it a bit like
you should
the
be able to say
EU
whether we want to change it.
Or almost every other thing that we do and vote for, it's a ratchet system. You're only going to go one way, Mark.
Well, I mean, I actually do agree. I think the legislation is changing. As I said, I think you need to have a supermajority overrule in council so that they can control the mayor better. I do think we need to have the same legislation as other cities, so we could get rid of the mayor if we, or the mayoral system if we wanted to. But the thing is, I actually prefer the mayoral system, although it needs changing, to the system we had before, because at the very least we get to vote for who is in charge. Now, I've sat in councils where you had a minority, for example Lib Dem administration, that pressed ahead with something deeply unpopular, which is like the sale of the green space. It got called to council, council rejected it, and they carried on. But the problem there was you couldn't vote against them. They're you know, the only person
that
voted for the leader
was 8,000.
But can't
George do exactly the same if he disagrees with what councillors are saying?
But then the thing is, we get to vote to kick him out next year. The city as a whole couldn't vote to kick out the Lib Dems. They only needed to hold certain seats in certain areas. This, at least this way, the whole city gets to make a decision.
Also, when it comes to
election... It's not perfect. I'm just saying the other system was deeply flawed as well.
When it comes to election time next year, we've got the whole full council elections of every single seat on the city council.
On
as
new boundaries.
As well as the mayor.
So, as well as the mayor and the police and crime commissioner.
So what are your thoughts about what those changes to the boundaries are going to mean?
Well, I think they're better representative of community balance. It's not perfect. It never is. I think as soon as you put a line down the middle of a road, you're making a distinction that may or may not be true, but hopefully it's a bit better. And it's certainly more balanced population-wise. We had wards in the centre of the city that were almost twice as large as they needed to be. I'm thinking of areas like Lawrence Hill and Ashley and Cabot. These were massive wards. They really did need changing. They were two-member wards, and they could have been three.
Going back to this edition of Our City, when I picked it up, I thought, oh, but as I started to read it, I just felt insulted as to the way it is also. It's like a PR leaflet. In fact, the same week, we've had this thing through from Wessex Water, Wessex Water's magazine. Yeah. Of course, Wessex Water, Bristol Water, have been classified by Ofwat as the worst private water providers in the country, because they've been told, Bristol Water have anyway, that they've got to reduce their water bills because they want to build a new spanking new reservoir in Cheddar, and Ofwat have said you don't need one. Yeah, so this is actually what you're doing is you're overcharging customers if you say you do need it because you don't need it. And they've also been actually using domestic supplies, that's you and me folks, to subsidise the big bulk their friends who are the big companies in the area. So that's also a bit of an insult. And to add insult to injury, they're using our money, we're paying our bills for, to legally challenge Ofwat. They're the only company in the country that's taken Ofwat to court to say, oh, we don't think we should do what we're told by the regulator. So, you know, this I find a little bit too similar, this wonderful Wessex Water magazine that we've got through, to this Our City. It's just produced by PR people. Why should we be paying for this? We're paying council tax. If we don't pay it, we go to jail. And yet George is using it to produce another magazine, which is effectively just to add to the already massive amount of positive publicity he gets through the Bristol Post.
If you want, I can repeat everything that I've just said to you for the last 10 minutes, but I really do think we're in agreement.
Just
you're quite het up on this,
just,
I can tell.
Just
would you like me to interview
just
you?
Remind
on exactly
our,
what
just
you
remind
think about
our
this?
Just remind our listeners of how much it cost again, please, Mark.
$34,000.
Martin, is this the way things are going? That actually, surely, you know, ordinary people don't want £34,000 spent on a pro-George Ferguson, very one-sided publicity magazine to be forced through their door.
Well, I think there may be a case for having some kind of publicity function, but it's got to be less partisan than that. Wessex Water, I feel even more angry about, because I live in a one-bedroom bedsit flat, and I'm being absolutely astronomically charged for what I don't have I've got a shower and a tap, and for that I'm paying £40 a month, and it's completely outrageous the amount of money that they're screwing out of people. And I can't change my supplier. There's no possibility. I'm entirely reliant on Ofwat to cut these people down.
I'm going to
size.
Point the finger right fairly and squarely now, my finger. Sorry, it looks a bit rude here in the studio, but this is privatisation, isn't it? This is Margaret Thatcher.
Maybe,
this is the Conservative
Party.
Let's
think about it. You said you can't change your supplier, so maybe the problem here is actually there isn't enough competition in the water sector at all. Well, maybe you should flip it on its head. Maybe there needs to be a greater degree of free market access.
Well, I would just... my economics professors would simply laugh at that. It's the reason why Scottish Water remains in the hands of the Scottish Government and why Welsh Water is a not-for-profit company is because water, above all, is a situation where you cannot... I mean, how many pipes do you run to each individual house? effectively competition. This is why these industries were nationalised in the first place.
Yeah, but how many electricity cables do you run to houses, and yet you can still change your supplier?
Well, the yes, but I mean that's turned into a bit of a dog's breakfast as well. In fact, there's a strong case for network industries where you've got what happened with telecoms, for example, was with the new technology, it was possible to have more competition. So BT did eventually get privatised and it was all broken up. But you still see people putting in extra cables. We were told at one stage that there wouldn't be extra cables. And I remember looking at Brixton Road where Mercury were putting in new cables. And, of course, you don't want lots of different sets of cables. And all of this is the case for network industries to be publicly controlled is overwhelming.
Just going to have to step in on that one. You do need new cables because the technology has changed. Fundamentally, it has changed. I mean, if listeners can basically make a circle with your thumbs and your fingers, okay, so you're creating quite a large line. Now, on the old style telecommunication cable, that would take about 200 phone calls. Mm. Now, with fibre optic, you can have a hair on your head thickness wire, and that can take every phone call in the world simultaneously. You need new cables, so technology has changed.
Yeah, but you can have new cables under public ownership, but I think the real change in the technology is that they're not using cables
at
all.
Folks, can I just intervene here because we've lost the principle here, which is that the infrastructure of the nation...
We're enjoying the fight.
If the country is going to be successful, if people doing business, going about their daily work, are going to be successful, the infrastructure of the country should be provided at cost. Then people can just get on with their lives without being caught up in some kind of racket where they're being way overcharged, you know, just purely for the benefit of shareholders.
What you're saying there is you're reckoning that if the government nationalises all the infrastructure, that it will run it the most efficient way it can, and that it will do it entirely at cost. I think what you'll find is if they are in control absolutely everything, then if there's a budget deficit, they'll slowly creep the cost up and it'll be used to cross-subsidise something else. I think the solution here, I'm sorry, is you need to have a properly functioning free market with competitors. You can switch between the two and we hold them to account. The energy sector has gone too much racketeering. And I'm happy to see there are smaller companies now breaking into it. I mean, hell, the council itself is trying to launch the Bristol Energy Company to create a rival to this. And I think actually getting proper competition into the sector where people can move providers at will and at ease is the way to do it, rather than relying on the benevolence of government and the whim of the day.
Well, can I just say on that, competition, if you read an economics textbook, doesn't happen until you've got hundreds of providers. Hundreds or possibly thousands. Five or six doesn't do it. That is chapter three called oligopoly. And basically, they price fit.
I'm not denying that at all. And this is one of the problems that the last Labour government had, actually under Ed Miliband, is that we went from having about a dozen companies to having six, and now it looks like we're in five. Mm. So,
but that's what happens in oligopolies. They tend to consolidate.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is why
you need to look at the monopoly rules and set a better threshold than there currently is.
I think you've got to accept that certain industries, because of the technology involved, are not competitive in their structure. They're naturally imperfectly competitive.
No, if they're properly regulated, they can do it.
No, I think that's I would argue the opposite.
We could be here in about an hour.
Conservatives in the past would have accepted, and I'm talking about a generation ago, that there was a clear case for certain industries to be run by the government. And there was no real argument about it. I mean, things like the rail industry, for example. And I think where technology is changing rapidly, so things like telecommunications, then there's a strong case for changing the structure. But where the technology is fixed, things like water pipes, the old ways are the best.
Don't agree, but fine.
Okay, let's move on. And earlier this week, there was an announcement by the Conservative government that people were going to be stopped from electing or having a referendum on whether their school is going to be changed into an academy. Before we hear from John Rediford from the National Union of Teachers, Mark, what are your thoughts about this and why have they done it?
Well, I mean, I think what they were saying basically, if schools are coasting in the sort of inadequate category, I think it was, or needs improvement, then they will be forcibly changed into an academy because what there wasn't working. I think what they're trying to do is to increase the academic freedoms that school have via academies and basically make them do it so that they don't just sit there comfortably coasting along and letting kids down. And actually it's about trying to improve standards. And actually, I have to say, I support the principle of academies. I think they work.
I mean, for example, though...
I'm not, by the way, saying that state schools don't also work.
Let's look at Nailsea Academy, for example. Okay. It's one school which was turned into an academy, and it actually has been performing very badly as a result, or rather badly, should we say. I don't want to insult Nailsea School, but they haven't been doing very well. They haven't had any kind of an Ofsted inspection. So, to a certain extent, you know, you can see that the Ofsted, where they actually go and have a look, as is there's a certain amount of politics in that. Anyway, look, let's have a listen now to...
Okay, I'm going to come back though on Bristol's example. Look, I mean, if you look at the secondary schools in Bristol, and I realise there was some bad press in the summer with one of them, but actually standards, educational attainment in Bristol has gone up in the last 4 years. Now, I'm not saying that's because they've all become academies. I think it's because you have a lot of hard teachers doing a lot of hard work. But the fact that they had the freedom to do so, I do think has to have helped.
Martin, just before we hear from the NUT again, let's give you your say on this.
Well, I'm actually working in an academy at the moment, which is actually quite a well-run place.
Is it primary, secondary?
It's a primary school academy. I'm generally opposed to this dog's breakfast system. I think you've got to have a basic standard of education which every child should receive. And it should be based locally. What we're actually doing is wasting a lot of money. Lots of free schools and academies have been set up and been unviable, and we've wasted millions setting up academies and free schools which haven't in fact got off the ground. And that actually, and we're also getting a situation where we're getting covert selection going on, which means that some schools look better because they're basically getting rid of the kids who drag them down, and they end up somewhere else and somebody else has to deal with them.
Okay, well, let's hear from the National Union of Teachers, from I think he's Secretary of the branch in North Somerset, John Redford, now speaking to Angela Balassi earlier this week.
Teachers who leave the profession, you know, they will probably go on to something else, so it's not too bad for them. But they, you know, the high turnover of staff in a school is not good for children, particularly younger children in primary schools. The Parliamentary Education Select Committee, which is chaired by a Conservative MP, so there's no allegations of political bias can be made here, concluded that there is no evidence to show that academies or academy status improves a school. Similarly, the National Foundation of Education Research has also investigated this, and their conclusion was that there is no significant improvement in the rate of GCSE improvement in academy schools over non-academy schools. Certainly in this sort of most recent set of results a year or so ago, the newly converted academies, their results improved at a lower rate than most schools. I work in North Somerset, and there's, you know, I'm not going to name schools on air, but there is one academy school that had an additional visit by Ofsted because their results were so low last year. That happened in December, January. There's another school that's seen falling results year on year, and those where the results haven't fallen, they have remained steady. They haven't improved. So academy status of itself does not improve results in schools. It just doesn't work. Ofsted will, of course, say that they're an independent body. They have fixed criteria. They go into schools and they judge them on the evidence that they see. But there is a lot of speculation that it is very political, that schools which fail are more likely to have been schools that aren't academies. If academies aren't doing very well, then often they're not visited by Ofsted. And there's two secondary schools in North Somerset where... believe this is the case of Ofsted have avoided visiting because they wouldn't give very good reports and they don't want to give a poor report to a newly converted academy. A couple of years ago, there was, your listeners may remember, in the summer of 2012, there was quite a lot of national scandal over the English language GCSE results, where there'd been clear interference from the then Education Secretary so that the grade boundaries were lifted, so fewer schools got as good results. The school in Bristol that my daughters go to subsequently failed its Ofsted inspection because of interference in GCSE English language results. The GCSE results and all the other subjects were fine, and that school has now been forced into academy status. So I think Ofsted is a very political body. But the schools that aren't getting good results year on year clearly need support, and simply changing status isn't going to give support in many ways. It might give less support. Local authorities, although less money has been spent on them, so they can offer fewer services, but local authorities do still have schools advisory teams. They have experts who can go in and work alongside head teachers and take teachers. So there are things that can be done to improve schools. Simply changing status is not automatically going to lead in that. I think, you know, often it might go the other way. If a school becomes a standalone academy, they don't have necessarily have those collaborative links with their near neighbours and their local authority, who can provide the kind of support needed to turn the school around. So it doesn't surprise me that the evidence is that academies don't work in terms of improving results. When this proposed bill, the news of it was announced, one of the justifications for passing it was to stop parents campaigning to stop academy status. Well, you know, and that has happened in a number of schools where there's been suggested conversion to academy status, that parent groups have campaigned against it. So why the education secretary would want to stop parents campaigning against that academy status is completely beyond me, but I do think she's got her own very strong political vision of what schools should look like, and that's why they're converting, not because of any evidence.
There seems to be a bit of a logical mismatch here, Mark, between this idea of if a school is failing, it's got to become an academy and the parents have no say in it. And yet the evidence from the Education Select Committee is that making it an academy does not actually improve the results from the school.
I think what it does, though, is it makes the school and its leadership team far more accountable for its actions. I do believe in academies because I like the idea they have greater budgetary independence, they have greater academic independence, and I've seen firsthand the kind of benefits that can bring.
But it's not bringing better results. That's the point.
It doesn't everywhere. I mean, no, but it does in a lot of places. I can't sit there and defend every single school on it. I don't particularly like the idea that it is forced on parents, but I think one of the problems is sometimes if a school, it's not failing, it's just coasting without any prospect of achievement, then a change needs to happen. And I think this might be one of those ways to try and do it.
Martin, what do you make of this, the idea that schools have got to become an academy? Because that means that effectively it can be run by a private charity, a private business, and actually the local authority doesn't have any kind of say and in control anymore. It's not coordinated with the other local schools, is it?
Well, also, it means that they're directly responsible to central government. So, you know, in other words, we're getting rid of the local input.
It's a centralisation of power.
Yes, a centralisation of power, direct centralisation. I mean, I remember there's a quote.
How do you call it decentralisation of power? Yeah, I take issue on that.
Yeah, but I mean, the parents, what can happen in these schools is they become little dictatorships. What's happened to my cousin, for example, who's been a primary school teacher for over 30 years. She's in East Dorset, where they've got virtually every kind of school you can imagine. They've still got grammar schools.
Good.
Mixed
schools are
well, all right, but we're not going to go. I'm not going to go and argue with you. I'm just saying that they have got all of that. But what has actually happened? She's been working in academy schools, and if you fall out with your head teacher, the head teacher, as you say, controls the budget. So the head teacher in the school she was in had three deputy heads who were all on high salaries, who were her mates, and she didn't have enough money left to provide the extra support in the classroom that was required for her to achieve her targets. And therefore, she lost her job in one school and then lost her job in another school after 30 years. And if you run up against one of those little bullies as a teacher, then the idea that you've got no comeback and that the locals can just tell you
Martin, can I just add something here? It could be that your relative, whoever it was you were talking about there, was not a very good teacher.
I disagree completely. I think she's been doing it for 30 years. We're not talking about a student teacher. And I think a lot of teachers will tell you, my parents are teachers on both sides, and a lot of my family are teachers. And what they will say, they will quote from Quintilian, who was a Roman.
Really,
chap.
They will quote from Quintilian.
Some will quote.
They're
from
very good teachers. Yes, they can randomly quote from Quintilian.
What Quintilian said years ago, he said, he was talking about the Roman army. He said, we trained hard, we learned everything we needed to do, we understood exactly what we needed to do, we'd done everything and we trained really hard, and then they changed the system. And what schools and teachers have been saying for years is you can't keep changing the system at the whim of every new Secretary of State, because this constant change. Just imagine when a failing school is knocked down and rebuilt in a new form, the kids who are in that school at the time will not benefit from that by and large. You may in the long run improve
Martin,
it, or
let,
you may
let
not.
Mark, let Mark reply.
Yeah, I mean, interesting. We'll come back to the Roman Empire in a minute. But I would say on that situation, the issue there lies with the Chair of Governance. The Chair of Governance should take a stronger hand, and the governor should have held the head teacher to account more. That is what you need. You need a robust governorship on it.
Well, what's happening in the
And when you raise the Roman Empire, what killed the Roman Empire off in the end was stagnation, because they stopped adapting to the threats that were outside their borders. And I'm afraid the world out there is different now. Very different to what it was. We have rising academic powerhouses coming in the east of the world, and we are going to have to meet those challenges. Now, that means we need to drive up standards and use every tool at our disposal to do so. Because if we just coast, if we allow schools to just coast and you know, just proceed as they were without trying to drive up standards, then it's not... It's not the schools that are going to suffer. It's actually the children who aren't going to be able to survive in a global jobs world.
All right, you mentioned the global race, if you like.
Yeah.
Now the top, they do these. I think they're called PEPSIS or something. Where they check kids of 18 across the world for things like maths, science, all the rest of it. Yeah. Now the top nation in Europe. They're not the top in the world, because the top in the world are all are like China, Singapore.
Although I would say China has about six different
ones it puts indeed. In. But the point is about...
It cuts out the provinces that are failing and just puts those that are succeeding.
Well, indeed. And of course, they're trying to change their system to a more flexible system, and in Japan, for various reasons. Because they don't have the kind of... But the top nation in Europe, by far, and they're the top fifth in the world, is Finland.
Yep.
Now, in Finland, they have an absolutely comprehensive system. They abolished private schools 50 years ago, and they have a system in which you go to the local school, and that's where you go. And they also have child-centred learning. They only have one exam when they're 18, and their kids are the best in Europe. Nothing like what you're proposing. And in actual fact, the teaching profession knows that. They know that the Tory government knows virtually nothing about what goes on in state schools. And therefore, they come up with their wizard wheezes, which have nothing to do with the reality of what really... We really need to change the system in this country to a properly comprehensive system. We've never done it. It needs to happen.
The NUT took issues with virtually every education reform that the Labour government did. As far as I can tell, the NUT has opposed almost every academic reform for the last 20 years.
Well, that's what trade unions often do, and it's sometimes that they're right.
But it's also leads to stagnation, and sometimes they're wrong.
Okay.
Sometimes, and sometimes they're not.
We'll leave this, leave this hot subject for a moment, and not for a moment, for good, actually, and look at the Queen's speech and this whole proposal. We'll hear a little bit more as well from the Queen, but the idea of George Ferguson spreading his wings, becoming the mayor of the whole of the South West region.
To bring different parts of our country together, my government will work to bring about a balanced economic recovery. Legislation will be introduced to provide for the devolution of powers to cities with elected metro mayors, helping to build a northern powerhouse. My government will continue to legislate for high-speed rail links between the different parts of the country. My government will also bring forward legislation to secure a strong and lasting constitutional settlement, devolving wide-ranging powers to Scotland and Wales. Legislation will be taken forward, giving effect to the Stormont House Agreement in Northern Ireland. My government will continue to work in cooperation with the devolved administrations on the basis of mutual respect. My government will bring forward changes to the standing orders of the House of Commons. These changes will create fairer procedures to ensure that decisions affecting England or England and Wales can be taken only with the consent of the majority of members of Parliament representing constituencies in those parts of our United Kingdom.
Well, that's from last week's Queen's speech. Quite a lot, actually, on changing the way we're governed. And this promise of metro mayors. What is George going to become a metro mayor later this year, next year?
No. Sorry, you wanted a longer answer than no. Hell no. No, it's not going to happen. I think the problem we've got is that... If we're going to have a metro mayor style system, a shared administration, then you're looking at what they call the West of England Council. So it's North Somerset, Bath and North East Somerset, South Gloucestershire and Bristol coming together. And I think the fear from our neighbours is that at that point it becomes completely centred on Bristol, with about 40% of the population, and they start to lose out because of it. So I don't see them going down the metro mayor model. I think there is a great deal of potential to look at slightly lesser forms of devolution, combined transport authority. Hell, I mean, I'd love to have an integrated transport authority, but something like a combined transport authority where we work better, you know, buses don't stop at the border, so we can try and put better structures in there. We can share services, strategic housing, that kind of thing. But I don't think we're going to get the Northern powerhouse.
Again,
in some ways, I wish we would, but it's just not going to happen.
I mean, it's happened in Manchester, hasn't it? It's bizarre that Manchester now has a mayor controlling two billion annual budget who's never been elected, and they're saying, oh, it's okay, don't worry about it, we're going to elect someone next year, Martin.
Yes, well, I mean, talking of dog's breakfast, we were just talking about the school system is becoming a big dog's breakfast. So is the way in which we are governed becoming a big dog's breakfast. In a way, it's an advantage of the British way of doing things that we bodge along. Think about the Northern Ireland peace process and so on. But nevertheless, other countries like Finland, for example, look at us and roll their eyes.
Martin,
every time
there's some sort of discussion here, Martin, Finland seems to be the answer anyway.
Yeah, it's a wonderful country.
Maybe we should do the show from Helsinki.
Invite me to that one.
Anyway,
you'll pay the bill, yeah.
On this subject, there was Diane Abbott at Prime Minister's Questions this week who brought up the same.
I'm sure that was
topic.
A balanced view.
Diane Abbott. Devolution of powers to our nations, our regions, and great cities will be one of the themes of this Parliament. But does the Prime Minister accept that Londoners, under their elected mayor, will expect at least the same powers that are being devolved to the Northern powerhouse?
Well, I think it's a very powerful point the Honourable Lady makes, and there's been an ongoing discussion with the Mayor of London about what more powers can be... Well, he's running London, that's where he is, and he's doing a very, very good job. He's doing an excellent job. Very good. But I think the Honourable Lady's right, and we have devolved powers to London. We're very happy to go on having discussions about transport and about other economic powers to make sure London has created 500,000 more jobs over the last 5 years. It's a staggering performance, and we want that to continue.
Certainly, the Prime Minister David Cameron there presenting a pretty positive view of all this. But it does seem to me, Mark, like just more centralisation of power. It's less and less people deciding on how our taxpayers' money is spent and closer to London.
Well, actually, I have to say I disagree. I return back to the earlier comment. The problem that we had under the old system was that you would have the leader of the council and the cabinet, who had virtual authority, and they were elected from maybe 3 or 4 wards in the city, and the other 31 had no say on the leader.
But they were the majority party, weren't they?
Well, actually, often they weren't. They were often a minority party. And I've got to say, I've been councillor now for 9 years. Not necessarily. Again, wasn't always the case. 2008, I think it was a Labour administration that were the second largest party. But we'll get into proper political geek territory at that point. But the problem is, if they messed up, they weren't answerable to the city as a whole. At least with the advantage of the mayoral model is they answer to the entire city. And if the city don't like them, we can kick them out.
Yeah, but we could do that every year, couldn't we? All apart from every 4 years.
We could, because
you know, there were elections in thirds, I think
But you're only a third of the council was up, so you couldn't kick them out.
Well, you could if you
you'd have to spend 3 years to do it. You'd have to do it in specific chunks.
Well, you had actually no. I mean,
which
that's
actually
not, that's
creates
not quite
political
fair,
instability.
Mark, because the electorate had a go pretty much every year in affecting the, you know, which party was in power in the city,
but not in every part of the city. So actually, 2 out of 4 years, one part of the city couldn't make a decision either, because the other part was up, not it. And then you had a fallow year as well.
And I think people prefer that because, you know, I hate to be cynical, but people feel, people will promise all sorts of stuff before they get elected. Then they'll spend the next 4 or 5 years, however long it is, doing something that they want to do.
It's 4 years. No, I'm sorry.
I'm talking about Westminster too.
I think if you have the year up, so it's up by thirds every year, the problem for that is you have councillors spending far too long fighting each other and far too little time actually governing the well-being of the city. If you have the mayor and the council all up at one go, they've got mandate from the people, 4 years, do what they were elected to do, and if it fails, you vote them out. If it succeeds, you keep them in. I think it's a much better system rather than us having this political merry-go-round where everyone's clamouring for media attention all the time.
Yeah, I mean, my difference of opinion with you is I think quite often the governance of the city is about issues which were never discussed before, and that once an administration's in, it starts to do what it wants. For example, here, the mayor, apparently, we hear from the BBC, is reconsidering selling off the Avonmouth and Portbury docks. Bristol Port Company covers 2,600 acres and employs more than 600 people. Bristol's mayor says he will reconsider the sell-off of the freehold of the docks complex after opposition from councillors. So, this certainly wasn't in the manifesto. I, George Ferguson, would like to sell off the docks.
Yep, things always come up. The manifesto shows the broad area in which you're going to go, but things happen all the time. Things change. The world, you know, if you're on a four-year manifesto, the world 3 years ago is different from the one you've got now. There's an opportunity with the port to sell the freehold. I mean, the leasehold is there for 127 years.
What's your view on this? Should they sell it or not?
Actually, I don't have a problem with selling it. I think one of the... For me, it was about whether we're going to get value out of the sale, if we are, and I think we will. Will it affect my beloved Henbury Loop in the north of the city? And no, I don't think it will at all. And does it give us any less or greater control? And actually, it doesn't give anything at all. So for me, it was, will we get good value for money? And if invested properly, will that give us a greater return than waiting 125 years, 127 years actually, for us to take back the leasehold? And yes, it will.
The argument, Martin, is with the port particularly, is that the £10 million is actually a snip for the freehold's worth apparently far more than Ferguson's preparing to sell it off for.
I'd love to see some evidence of that.
Well, it's hard for me to comment because this is a very specific... in general, I'm against selling things off, but I don't know the detail of this, and therefore I hesitate to comment because I don't know enough about it to have a sense of...
Okay, well, if I might just come in on this, because I understand Martin's issue on it. I'm not for the council getting rid of assets that make us money. I mean, actually, the Taxpayers Alliance, I think, came out earlier in the week and had a go at councils because they had all these assets like a restaurant and things like that. But actually, if it makes money to support other services, I don't have a problem. It's like we had digital advertising in the week as well. It was another call-in. The issue for me is the port is 10 million. Now, the independent valuers came back with 1 million, and the port have offered 10, because what they want to do is they want to take the freehold so that it's no longer a wasting asset, and they can use that to bring in loans to build a deep-sea container port. Okay, so that's what I think is a good thing.
The fact is, though, that the council sold off the docks in 1991 by leasehold, and then it was worth £36 million. So why is it only worth 10 now?
Well, no, because you're talking about the leasehold and a freehold. There's a difference between the two.
The leasehold is actually £36 million, but the freehold apparently is only 10. So, it does seem like that it's been a massive drop in value.
No, it hasn't, because most of the value is actually in the leasehold. The leasehold gives you the day-to-day control.
You've got it much more power over
what happens. Don't. Until 127 years' time. At that point, the leasehold will revert to you, and you'll have what's called a marriage value between the lease and the freehold. Now, you have to make a estimate, and I've seen that, but I'm
amazed that you can say that you can get a lease on something rather than a freehold on something, and actually the lease is worth far more than the freehold would be.
It's the same as if you have a leasehold on a house. And it's the same as if you have the freehold on the house.
A freehold's worth more than a lease?
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
I'm genuinely sorry, but it's really not. If you have a 99-year lease on your house, the freehold is not worth anywhere near the value of the lease.
Right, okay, so this lease will stay in place, will it, this 150-year lease?
No, the 127-year lease. If the sale goes through, then they will have the freehold and the leasehold, that's there. Yeah. If the mayor decides not to sell it, then in 127 years' time, the port reverts back to the people of Bristol. And at that point, the freehold and the leasehold are combined.
So effectively what he's doing is he's taking away some power that the council has over it. But anyway, Martin...
No, because that's controlled by planning. Okay. The power to control the development at the port is controlled in the planning process. It gives us no less or no more power than we had 3 weeks ago.
Okay, well, clear as mud that one, but I can certainly see that there people might object if they felt that.
I totally agree. It is one of those you have to make a decision.
And there was another issue, wasn't there? I think about Charlotte Leslie, the MP, getting money from the as part of her campaign last year. Her constituency.
As far as I'm aware, actually, the port gave contributions to every party in the mayoral election. So Charlotte didn't take a contribution. I don't think she's taken a contribution from the port since 2011.
Okay, well, let's get on to housing now and the new Prime Minister's questions this week. First of a new session of Parliament. In the chair, let's see how she does, was Harriet Harman rather than Ed Miliband.
Harman!
He broke his promise.
promise on a replacement one for one of affordable council homes. He broke that promise, and as a result, housing benefit has gone up. And at the same time, he says he wants to take £12 billion out of welfare. So where is it coming from? Earlier this week, his spokesperson confirmed the government would not make any changes to child benefit, and that's a commitment for the whole of this parliament. Can he confirm that now?
Prime Minister.
We made a very clear opposition on child benefit in the election. I confirm that again at the dispatch box. But let's clear, absolutely no answer from the Labour Party about housing association tenants. We're clear, they should have the right to buy. So we can now see the new Labour backing of aspiration after the election. It's lasted 3 weeks. That's how long they've given to aspiration. Let me give her another chance. We say housing association tenants get the right to buy. What does she say?
And Harriet Harman, I ain't quite wise. She didn't answer the question because it's not opposition leader's question time. It's Prime Minister's question time. But anyway, Mark...
I understood the title to that, just on the side. Prime Minister's question. Does that mean he gets the right to ask the questions? Because that seems to be what he did.
It does, at the end. But and he didn't really necessarily answer the question either. But anyway...
Well, actually, he did.
He tried. He had a go.
He confirmed
but,
it.
But anyway, the specifics on this... We're in a bit of a bind, aren't we, with this whole business of benefits, Mark? Because... as Harriet Holman pointed out there, the housing benefit bill is rising. And also, we've got this thing in the background, I mean, not just about the issue of the sell-off of housing association houses, he's talking about the right to buy. We've also got this whole thing of £10.5 billion worth of benefit cuts being promised, if you can call it promised, up before the election, without any actual costing of it. So this is, I mean, if you had a disabled child, would you say, well, we're going to take 10... whatever it is away from you, but we're not going to tell you how and when we're going to do it.
Yeah, I think on this stage I would say let's not scaremonger. I certainly hope they're not
touching... That's a lot of money, £10.5 billion,
isn't it? I
certainly
hope they're not touching disability benefit, I really do. We're going to have to see. The government still has to make up the finances. We still have to live within our means, and that was quite clear before the election. We spoke about that we were going to be making cuts to the welfare bill, and we won the election, and now we are where we are. So it is going to happen, but I'm not going to set horses running. I, like you, want to see the detail in the July budget.
Martin, what are your thoughts about Harriet's performance and also Harriet Harman, deputy... Well, she's now interim leader of the Labour Party, the opposition leader.
And stepping down.
Quite soon, yeah. But, I mean, I actually think she does a bit better than... she sort of almost does better than Ned Miliband. It's almost like a kind of matronly lecture, you know. And also, she doesn't rise to the bait at all.
Well, I don't think there's much comment to make about that. I think the policy of allowing... Don't forget, housing associations are supposedly independent of central government. The whole point of making them in charge of social housing was that it wouldn't be controlled by government. They were going to be independent and make their own decisions. And then the Tory government just steps in and says, right, your assets, we're going to tell you what to do with them. That's point number one. Point number two, of course...
Funny, you were arguing for nationalisation earlier. Is that different?
Well, it is. The point is, I believe in council
housing.
Wasn't
that the same thing?
Well, no. Well, indeed, I'm just saying it's contradictory of the Conservatives to act in that way when they supposedly believe in decentralisation. Because the housing associations don't want to do this.
We believe in what
clear.
Works.
Yes, well, so do I believe in what works, and your housing policy doesn't and hasn't, and nor has the new Labour's housing policy over 13 years, and there is going to be a property crash. All that is going to happen with this at the moment, we're reaching the top of the property bubble, and this will just add a little bit more mess on the barbecue before it goes down the drain. And I've seen... How many property crashes have I seen under Tory governments in my lifetime? Three? There's going to be another one. And when it comes, of course, everybody's going to realise what a load of nonsense it all is. We should have been building council houses for generations, and we haven't. And already, of course, what's happening is people are ending up in absolutely substandard accommodation. The housing benefit bill's going through the roof. And, of course, people are being moved from pillar to post. Less people registered to vote this time than last time in most constituencies in the country, partly to do with the changes in regulations. But also, of course, they're then going to redraw the boundaries on the basis of existing electoral registers, which we know are incomplete, especially in the inner cities. It's gerrymandering. And, of course, we all know what happens with gerrymandering. We saw what happened in Northern Ireland in 1969. If you create a situation where you've gerrymandered everything, ultimately people won't be playing democratic politics at the end of that game.
So hold on, let me have a go. Let me just take back a little bit on that. People need to register to vote. Yeah.
In theory, but in practice,
well,
they don't.
No, no, it's not in theory. They should register to vote.
They don't.
And if
though,
they,
do
don't,
they
don't,
hang on,
then
Mark,
the representation.
Mark, don't fall. Some people hesitate to because they don't want to pay council tax and they don't want
well,
to
I'm
be.
On that
they
one.
Want
they
to stay,
also need
they
to
want
pay council
stay,
tax.
They want to
so
stay under.
Gonna,
the, they want to stay under the radar.
Well, afraid,
maybe they're an illegal migrant.
Well, they need to register to vote so long as they're eligible.
Supposedly, it's supposedly compulsory.
They need to pay council tax. I'm sorry, I'm not going to let them off. They shouldn't register to vote so they cannot pay council tax. They need to do both.
Well, what's actually happened is under the new system of having individual registration, clearly, I mean, Bristol West, for example, we know there's been an increase in the population, but there are less people registered to vote at the last election than there were at the election before. And that's because the system ain't working. If people were dragged through the courts for not registering and so on, but they're not, and they know they're not going to be. And ultimately, this is what they call in the US voter suppression. So the mobile poor, the trailer trash, don't register to vote, and in actual fact, that suits the spin doctors on the Republican side in the US. They don't want these people registered. They're quite happy for them not to register. And I think, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, that's what's going on here.
I don't think so, and I would also point out to the fact that you've had a Democrat president for 8 years or 7 years now. So why has nothing changed there?
Okay.
It's like your accusation when it comes to social housing. More council houses were built in the last year of the John Major government than the last five put together of the last Labour government.
Well, the last Labour government failed dismally. I totally accept that.
Okay, lovely. At least we got some agreement on that. And before we get off the subject of housing, Rachel Maskell brought it up at this week's Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday.
Rachel Maskell.
Yeah.
Under the Right to Buy plan, three social houses will need to be sold to generate enough revenue to build one new one, leaving 1,500 families in York without a home for well over 2 years. Is this what the Prime Minister means by aspiration?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me welcome the Honourable Lady to the House and congratulate her on her election victory. There are two things that we're doing to provide these replacement houses. One is obviously for every housing association that sells a home, it has that receipt and is able to build a new house. But also, we're making sure that councils actually sell off the most expensive council houses they have when they become vacant. In parts of London, there are council houses worth over £1 million, and you can build many, many more houses. But what's clear from this question time is on this side of the House, we understand home ownership, aspiration, people wanting to get on. The party opposite, after the most catastrophic election defeat in years, can't even begin to spell aspiration.
David Cameron's right, isn't he? You can't spell aspiration, the Labour Party.
No, it's A-S-P... Oh, I can't. No, you're right. These policies are simply wrong. I think the National Housing Federation have already made their opposition to what's being suggested clear. And don't forget, these people are not going to buy at market value. They're going to be given these properties at less than market value, which means they're going to be given a free handout of tens of thousands of pounds.
What the government is saying is that they think that they want to give people a bit of a leg up to get on the housing ladder.
Yes, well, so they're giving certain people a leg up, and other people are going to have to be kicked out of their houses because they can't afford to have a spare bedroom. There is no justice in this. The people at the bottom of the pile who suffer the most under the austerity policies have been pursued over the past 5 years, and they didn't cause the crisis. The crisis was caused by the banks, which have all been slapped on the wrist for all of the LIBOR fixing and all the rest of it. They should be in prison. All of their money should be confiscated, and it should be used to spend on council houses. Ultimately, these debates are going to be had. The Labour Party is not, in fact, going to drift into the middle ground here. You may think you may be happy about that, but that is not going to happen. I'm fairly confident that the grassroots of the Labour movement will not accept these unfair policies.
Well, I certainly hope the Labour Party veers to the left. I welcome the ideological battle.
But what about the housing
back
stuff?
On council. Let's take it back to the housing on it. As far as I'm aware, the right to buy legislation, and this is my understanding of it, is you can, although there is a discount to it, you cannot sell a house for less than it would cost to replace it. That is, or less than the cost to build a equivalent house. So you can replace it one for one. I do think they need to give people a leg up onto the housing ladder.
What Rachel Maskell from York's saying there, I'm guessing she's a Labour MP.
I think she is, that you
have to sell three houses to have the money to actually build a new one because you're getting quite a discount on the house.
I'm genuinely not sure that is the case. I'll have to check that.
The Prime Minister himself then said they will make up the money by selling off the most expensive houses, council houses. Mm. Now, I think there ought to be a consensus in this country that social housing is a good thing, that we shouldn't have a complete free market in housing, which ends up with slums and people sleeping in the streets. There used to be a wide consensus about this. The biggest builder of council houses in British history was Harold Macmillan in the 1950s. And the Conservative Party was proud to be part of that tradition at one stage.
Yeah, actually, I have to say, earlier on in one of the things you were talking about, it meant, or the snippet you played us, was a high-speed rail on HS2. Actually, I'm not a fan of HS2. Mm. I would scrap it, and actually I would split the money in half of it would be supporting suburban rail, and the other half I would build tens of thousands of council houses.
Well, I'm glad to hear it.
They need doing.
Yeah, well, there ought to be a consensus on that one.
Okay, let's move on to yesterday's announcement by Chancellor George Osborne that he's actually going to bring in £3 billion of cuts imposed earlier than expected, and he's been accused of tricking voters. Anyway, let's have a little clip from his announcement in the Commons yesterday.
At the start of this Parliament, it's important we continue to control spending in the same vein. 2 weeks ago, my right-hand friend, the new Chief Secretary, asked government departments to seek further savings beyond the £13 billion of savings that they are already delivering this year. And I can report this today. Together, we've got straight back to the task in hand. We have found a further £4.5 billion of savings we can make to the government budget this year, including sensible asset sales. £3 billion or so of these extra savings, £3 billion of these extra savings come from finding more efficiency in Whitehall departments and from the good housekeeping of coming in under budget. I am today announcing that the government will begin selling the remaining 30% shareholding we have in the Royal Mail. It is the right thing to do for the Royal Mail, the businesses and the families who depend on it, and crucially for the taxpayer.
Well, now, they're saying, or the Treasury spokespeople are saying, that this is all helping to pay off the national debt, selling off the post office. But actually, Martin, it's not really making much of an inroad into it.
Well, if we sell it for the price we sold the rest of it, which was way under what the market would actually bear, then that's clearly not the case. I think what they're going to make exactly... They're going to make exactly the same mistake this time as they did 5 years ago. That if the economy is actually weakening, globally and nationally. The property market is peaking. If they bring in cuts, politically, what you want to do is bring your cuts in early so that you can then ease up later on. But of course, from an economic point of view, that's not necessarily a good idea. And I think if they bring in swinging cuts too quickly, there's every possibility that they're going to stall the economy as they did last time and lost our credit rating, or more likely, it's going to crash.
Half a billion cuts in defence, Mark, that's what they're saying, and also pretty much the same, £450 million of cuts at the Department for Education.
Well, I'm going to be a little controversial, but that's probably a good thing. When it comes to sell the Royal Mail, the one difference thing this time is actually we can see what the market rate is because it's visible there, because 70% of it is now privately owned. So you have a benchmark. Last time they took a punt in the dark and they didn't get it right. And Vince Cable, well, he lost his seat, so I suppose it's sort of a done. The £3 billion savings, if they can make savings, that's a good thing. I personally don't like cutting the defence budget. I think our armed forces do a fantastic job, and we have international commitments on the NATO target. And I find it hard to justify increasing foreign aid spending and yet cutting defence. I'm afraid I was always a believer that charity starts at home, and I find this ideologically difficult for me.
Okay, finally, let's just wind up by mentioning the death of Charles Kennedy, former Lib Dem leader. What were your thoughts about him in half a minute, Mark?
I thought he was likeable, funny, totally disagreed with his politics. But he passed the pint test. And, politicians, I think for me, I rate them by how much I can enjoy a pint of cider with them. I think he would have been quite good fun. I'm not sure I'd have survived the evening, but it would have been quite entertaining on the way down.
Okay, Martin.
Well, I think that's probably a fair assessment of how I would view him. And, of course, the Liberal Democrats have not done terribly well of late.
Was it fair?
So it's very sad. There is other ways.
Okay, time for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock now, thanks to this week's guest. Who was? Yes, it's the Murdoch News, the Sky News. That's Mark Weston, who's the leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council. After the news, we look at the G7 and the Bilderberg Conference coming up next week.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.